25 years of exploring new worlds, new ideas, and new people. Years of entertaining conversation, stimulating information. Join the Celebration 25 with
Phil Jenkins.
Welcome in to a Saturday night. That's what it is. I'm Bill Jenkins. It's Open Mind, and for the next 3 hours, we want to stretch yours a little bit. Open it a little bit, and you may need to have one to stay with us, because tonight, our subject is an old friend, an old topic, and there may be some skeptics out there. We want you skeptics, turn your radio up loud. This is your night. We're going to talk about UFOs. And one of the gentlemen who is going to join us to talk about UFOs tonight is a newcomer to Open Mind, and we're very, very delighted to have him aboard. His name is John D. Herrera. John, welcome.
Good evening. Glad to be here.
Why am I talking to you about UFOs tonight?
Why?
Yes.
I don't know. Maybe you're interested in the skeptic debunking I do.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of my work.
Well, that certainly caught my attention, John. You're a part of MUFON and AFRO. You are into the UFOs. You have a technical background. You have, you're a technical writer. I don't think that you want the wool pulled over your eyes. I don't think that you want to go around believing in a myth, as it were.
No, I don't.
And what caught my attention is that you were looking upon the work of Randy and the Skeptics as rather a mythical enterprise that they're involved in, and you want to challenge them.
That's right. Guys like Randy misrepresent what they really stand for. Their sales pitch sounds very appealing.
Mm-hmm.
But if you really look into the backgrounds, what they really stand for, it's horrifying.
Well, let's remember that the word skeptics is a derivative of the Greek town of Skeptos, which was the city of ignorance.
Pyro, if I remember right, was the original skeptic. And then later on in the modern philosophy, there was David Hume, who also fought a lot with the religious people of his time.
Yeah.
17th century.
Well, you always, whenever you're on a forefront of thought, you're going to run into this. Now, I don't want to put the skeptics down altogether. I think healthy skepticism is a very, very important process of education.
Yes, it is.
And without it, you know, we could run amok. You know, our imaginations could just take us into all different directions. So we need to keep our feet on the ground. But at the same time, skepticism that is in itself run amok.
Right, absolutely.
Stops the advancement of mankind and the understanding of the world that we live in and the realities.
Right, they throw obstacles in our way.
For reasons of ego, usually more than
right,
anything else.
Right, definitely.
But let me ask you a few questions. Now, you have been involved in the research of UFOs for some time. Is there such a thing as a UFO?
Yes, they're very real.
And
that's what I've been trying to tell people. The Herald Examiner offered a $10,000 prize recently for evidence, show evidence of a UFO encounter. And I thought, great, this is my chance to get some of my new information out.
All right.
So I accepted this challenge and discussed it with Al Seckel, and we agreed on the preliminaries. And then I found out that the money was really from Randy, and I was supposed to contact him and make arrangements. And knowing Randy, I knew there was no hope of ever...
You know, I've never had the opportunity to meet Randy, but I have had an opportunity to meet a number of people who are involved in... there are psychics, for instance. There are people who can walk on hot coals, which
right.
I do. There are people in the UFO investigation. I mean, you're looking now at classified government documents. We have the government of the United States saying that there are UFOs.
Right.
And they didn't like to give up that information, but out of the Freedom of Information Act, they had to.
Really.
The government has had.
The CIA.
Had
FBI
to admit that there are UFOs.
A lot of documents.
But then we find that When you start confronting these people with this kind, this level of information, they do things like this letter you have here that you sent to Randy and
right.
was refused.
However, Randy's last letter
had been opened and sent back to you, refused.
Randy's last letter, he warned me that part of the agreement that's in his book, Flim Flam, that I was to send a self-addressed stamp envelope, that his last two letters, he had to pay the postage, that owed him 44 cents. That if I would send that in to him, he would reply to my request for the $10,000 challenge and proceed.
Mm-hmm.
So I did that. I sent him his 44 cents and a letter, a nice lengthy letter. And this is what I got back. Refused.
Refused an open letter.
But he didn't refuse it. He actually steamed the letter open, did a sloppy job. You can see all the seams are coming apart. Put a little bit of glue on the top flap. And
he didn't want to get up his $10,000 because
no.
Randy has had to have seen by now the documents that are flowing out of the
He's
government.
He's afraid that...
Certainly the documents that have come out of the incident in the recent incident in England and the one in northern New York around
right.
Brewster, New York.
He knows I'm serious about this thing.
Yeah.
I've been around a while.
So the skeptics are on notice. Any time that Randy or any of the skeptic group want to get together at these microphones
right.
and do their thing with... the UFO people who can do their
I'd
thing.
Like to meet this guy. I know he's correct.
Welcome to the birds in May. I may have to shuffle somebody around.
He's not
going to
fool me one bit.
Put him on there. Well, what's some of the new information that you have about the UFOs, the reality of the UFO? John, we want to talk about that, and I know that the audience would want to talk to you about what they have seen, what they want to know about.
Right. There are so many people out there that have seen UFOs, and that's where the heaviest evidence really is when you get... You've talked to someone who's seen a UFO up close. I'm talking 100 feet, 200 feet,
mm-hmm.
and when there's more than one witness. All of these documentaries and books are just full of lights in the sky a great distance away, and there's no need to fool around with that kind of... when we have so many good sightings.
Well, this is one of the things that we talk about here, because I agree with you, and just from the people I've talked to, the calls that come in when we talk about UFOs in this show, a lot of people have seen a lot of lights.
Right.
And the lights are rather dramatic, and there's something to see, lights in the sky that are doing things that they're not supposed to be. I've seen that once, where
mm-hmm.
I thought it was a satellite coming over, and all at once it stopped and did a 90-degree turn to the left, and then a 90-degree turn to the right.
Don't do that.
And in fact, we sat out, my whole family and a lot of our friends, and watched this cavorting around in the sky. Mm-hmm. Balloons don't do that. For, I guess, about an hour and a half, and then all at once it kind of locked into position with one of the constellations, and then just floated off into, the nighttime sky.
We get a lot of those.
But, all you can see is a light. There are so many more fascinating contacts that people have had where you can see the ship itself. You can see the lights in the ship. You can see maybe it landing or hovering or doing other strange things. And, of course, others have gone on and had other encounters, which are
right.
are quite fascinating in themselves. How deeply involved are you, and why did you get into the UFO phenomenon?
Well, that's a long story, and I've...
Make it short.
I guess I could...
Make it short and tell us about it.
Be brief.
Well, before
I'm
you
a
do,
youngster.
Before you do that, I'm going to have to do something that I'll have to do from time to time mm-hmm. throughout the course of the evening. And that's pause for a minute, take a sip of coffee, sell you something. It's Open Mind. John D. Herrera is with me. John is with APRO and MUFON, which is a UFO investigative organization, and two very, very fine ones. He has a lot of information, and you'll have a chance to talk to John in just a few minutes about the reality of the UFO. And we want to talk to you about the UFO, any of the questions that you may have about it. Speaking of that, let me have that little computer readout I gave you a second there, John, about what's coming up, because we're going to continue this next week in a very different fashion. We'll talk about the UFOs as they are existing right now and the latest information on them and what we have found out. But next week in studio will be author and researcher Zachariah Sitchin. Zachariah has written two really formidable books in the past. One of them is called The Twelfth Planet, the other one Stairway to Heaven. And his newest book is called The Wars of Gods and Men. Now, Zachariah's research deals with the ancient records of the Sumerians and the writings out of Mesopotamia and Babylonia. And what we see is that there were some very early science fiction writers back there, or they were making some very accurate observations about what was going on in their world, about the intervention into Earth life of alien beings. And as Zechariah will point out in his new book, The Wars of Gods and Men, that the first nuclear war on this planet occurred 2002 B.C., and that comes out of the ancient record, and we'll discover how the area of Mesopotamia and Babylonia was devastated by that, and by the way, still is as of today. It's just arid wasteland, and it was a nuclear blast that happened back there, a nuclear war. So I invite you to join me next week for that. On July 27th, one of the most important shows of the year will occur here as Thomas E. Bearden joins me again. Thomas is leading America's efforts in the research into Soviet weather control, and it is now the contention of a large group of scientists, and we'll go into that with you, that the United States is engaged in an undeclared war with the Soviet Union, and the weapons is weather. And the weather that we've been experiencing this last week, I think you will find out, was engineered by the Soviet Union. The weather we experienced last December and January here in Southern California, across New Mexico, Arizona, into Texas, and on up the Adirondack chain where they had record low temperatures, was engineered by the Soviet Union. That only killed 430 people. And we lost the corn crop the year before because of Soviet weather engineering. Half the corn crop. And they were just playing around. I invite you to join me on the 27th of July for Thomas Bearden. We'll show you exactly how that's done, the science behind it, and why it is something we do need to pay attention to. I think that perhaps we can add three more to the list of casualties in this undeclared war as of the events here in Los Angeles in the last week. On August 3rd, Dr. Philip Berg will be with me. He is the world's leading expert, I guess, on the Kabbalah, the Jewish oral history. And the Kabbalah has many fascinating things to tell you about the reality of the UFO, reincarnation, out of body, and all of those other things, which was a part of the Jewish mysticism. And Dr. Berg and you and I will have a chance to go into that. We'll get into the out of body experience on October 24th with Robert Monroe of the Monroe Institute of Applied Sciences. He will be here. On August 7th, Thomas Jacobson, one of the finest transmediums you'll ever have a chance to talk to, will be here, and also Dr. Peoples, who works through Thomas, will kind of interact with you. A little bit later, on September 14th, Dr. Russell Targ and Keith Harari, who was so very, very instrumental in the research that went on at the Stanford Research Institute concerning the development of ESP and
remote viewing
particularly. And the authors of The Mind Race will be our guest, and they have a handheld electronic device that was developed for NASA to train you in developing your ESP and remote viewing skills. You'll have a chance to talk to them about that. So we have quite an exciting summer coming up here on Open Mind. But right now we have John D. Herrera, and we're talking UFOs. How'd you get into the UFO study, John?
Well, I've always been interested in anything that's scientific or technical, and I read a lot, and my mother had seen something when she was about 13 years of age, looking out the window of grandfather's ranch. She saw this glowing object come down, land near the ranch. So she told me about that, and my grandmother had related some other stories. And I knew they were serious, yet I couldn't believe it was anything supernatural. So I've been attempting ever since to find answers to these UFOs and ghosts and what have you.
Have you found it?
Yes, I think I have. I was fortunate enough to see a UFO myself.
How close?
In 1956. Well, it was less than 100 feet. It was daylight, and there were probably 18 other people there.
Where was this?
My younger brother and I had a paper route outside of Alamosa, Colorado, the home of Snippy and a lot of UFO stories. Well, anyhow, we were delivering newspapers. It was still light. We came on the Highway 160 headed towards Blank and Fort Garland. And about 300 yards ahead of us, there was some tall trees in the farmhouse. We saw this object come around the trees and towards us on the left side of the highway. And then it shot upward into the sky and as it came alongside our pickup. Then it turned and crossed the highway directly over the top of our pickup. So it must have been maybe at the closest point, 50 feet in distance. And we got a pretty good look at it. I was trying to avoid running into the other cars I was driving, so my brother got a much better look than I did. And it was rather embarrassing to say that this thing was egg-shaped. Didn't have any windows or airfoils. Just plain egg-shaped.
Just kind of worked off different principles.
I just wished it would have had a canopy and aliens looking out, but I've got to be truthful about it, and that's all I saw. But as it shot up into the sky, there was what appeared to be a flame coming out of the back of it.
It did have a flame.
So there was some kind of propulsion, ionic maybe.
Who knows?
Who knows?
It's really kind of dumb, I think, for us to try to apply our science to the science of someone who's able to get a craft here from wherever they come from.
Right.
As if our little planet Earth here is the citadel of all knowledge. For the universe.
With that experience, I was a confirmed believer, you might say, in UFOs, so all I had to do was find out what they were, not to convince myself that they were real.
In your work with MUFON and with APRO, which are two of the finest organizations, and again, you're not interested in chaff, and you're not interested in propagating a myth, you're interested in raw data, hard facts. What are some of the more outstanding things that you've come across in those investigations?
Well, my specialty is the balls of light, intelligent balls of light that are associated with UFOs. And I find that these will come into homes late at night. And
what are they?
Well, scientists keep talking about these plasma balls and ball lightning and what have you. And maybe there's two kinds, I don't know. But these things
seem
to have
an
intelligence.
There's a natural kind of ball lightning that happens.
Right, absolutely.
There are 1,800 different points on the Earth that will produce those at any given time.
Let me tell you a short story about a man in Van Nuys is sitting in his living room watching television. It's about 10 o'clock in the evening. And his window is slightly open, and he looks over corner of his eye, and he sees this ball of light drop out of the sky, come through that opening in the window, circle around his room as it right at the same altitude as the posters he's got, Star Wars posters and all that, and goes along the television, and when it goes by the chair he's sitting in, it pauses for a minute, and goes around the chair, then shoots back towards the open window and goes back out. So if that's some
a drug.
Ball lightning, maybe so.
That's not natural ball lightning. No.
But then you take other cases where these balls of light have taken human form and spoken to people, and that kind of shoots down the ball lightning theory.
Not a natural thing.
No, not at all. In Zaytun, Egypt, in 1968, there were hundreds, if not thousands, of people that saw some of these balls of light. And got as close as 8 feet to some of these. And
were they
many
hot?
Good photographs.
Were they hot, the balls?
Well, no, they didn't report any heat sensations. But they got some good photographs.
You have those photographs?
Not with me, but I can sure make
you can sure bring
show
it.
Them to anyone.
Anybody that wants to see them.
And I'm surprised there wasn't a lot of publicity on this.
You know, I have found that the best interrogators in the world are the people who listen to this program. They ask much better questions than I do. And I'll ask questions along the evening, but I want to give our audience a chance to talk to you, John, an investigator from MUFON and APRO. You are a technical writer in the aerospace industry. You understand a lot of the science that is involved. And certainly I think you're able to see that whenever a lot of these things are doing things that defy our conventional view of physics and how the world operates. Of course, we're finding out that we don't know about that there are a lot of mistakes in our electromagnetic theory. In fact, the conventional electromagnetic theory is on the shelf now. It doesn't really operate the way most people think it does. Let me give you the telephone numbers if you'd like to get in. We'd like to talk UFOs with you tonight. Welcome aboard.
Well, hello there. I had a couple thoughts
about
UFOs that I wanted to relate and see if the hypothesis which emerges from this makes any sense to your guest. It seems to me UFOs are rather good at avoiding the kind of plentiful documentation that we see with things like tornadoes, and there's even a number of films that exist of meteors, fireballs going through the atmosphere and such, and yet there's hardly anything of any real quality in the motion picture film, and little besides ambiguously, tiny objects on film as far as still photographs are concerned. Anyway, the point is that...
Not exactly correct, Don, but go ahead.
Okay. I'm talking about, plentiful, comfortably unambiguous evidence photographically, but they tend to avoid places where there are huge numbers of people with cameras and observatories and such.
I don't know. They've been to places where there were 10,000 people taking 10,000 pictures of them, particularly in Rome is one of the places that I remember in the last couple of years where thousands of people.
Yes, please tell us who's out there at night with a camera trying to photograph these.
Well, there are a lot of amateur astronomers, for instance, and all-night cameras at the Prairie Network that photograph meteor trails all night long, every night.
Mm-hmm.
And they tend to avoid being within the point of view of places like that which are steady places that have for decades have been doing this. The point is, it's almost as if there's a intelligence directing these that... It's people have access to the historical record, and they're able to avoid places where they can be documented by all the official sky documentation centers that exist. My point is that I think that the UFOs are they are a physical manifestation of advanced means that we will have one day in the future of looking back into the past. And the movements you describe as far as intelligent movements of a bright object in the sky is like a discontinuity in our reality caused by these looking devices of people in the future as they move their point of view from one place to another. That way they could appear to zip around and apparently defy laws of angular momentum and such, although in reality it's just like as if you take a telescope and you're looking at one part of the moon and then the other and you can zip around, your viewpoint can zigzag impossibly fast, but it's just a matter of how you adjust your little, your telescope. Now, it's a minority theory that UFOs may come from the future, but I think that it satisfies the requirements, including the fact that the beings usually look somewhat humanoid, while in reality you'd probably expect more random reshuffling of genetic parameters that end up making an alien form in a very alien planet. So we're seeing ourselves in the future looking back at us because they're curious about us.
That probably they've learned enough about us not to get around us too much. I mean, we're talking about getting into a snake pit here. Would you deliberately go down among this group?
Right. They are intelligent, much more so than, say, animals and so forth. They avoid us. Occasionally you're popping up and scaring the heck out of someone.
Well,
they don't last long enough to...
When we have a philosophy, if we don't understand it, we kill it. You don't want to get around.
No, you see, they don't interact physically with us in real sense. They just look at us like they look like more than a will-o'-the-wisp in the air. But in actuality, you see, time travel and such, physical laws dictate against physical interaction between time because you get into paradoxes and such. But
I hear you use some terms here, Don, called physical laws, as if the laws of physics that you're dealing with there were fingered by God on some stone on Mount Sinai and brought down. Those are not physical laws. That is just the sum total of some of the observation that some of our learned men have made, and we're finding out that those things are not laws at all, but they were incorrect hypotheses.
Well, we're talking about logic. You know what I'm talking about. Like, if you go back into the past and kill your mother before she conceives you and that sort of stuff. That's logic more than...
You saw that movie, didn't you?
We all tuned in last night for the time.
Really? Well, do you see any
yes, that's a possibility.
In the possibility the UFOs are from the future.
We can't rule that out, no.
Absolutely not. We already can in the laboratory, and we have seen we can bend space-time. And, in fact, we're using that now in some of the weapon systems that are being developed here in the United States and have been developed in the Soviet Union. So bending space-time is not a physical impossibility. It is
No, that's a proven fact.
That's a proven fact, and it does happen. And we actually do it all the time. We just are not aware of the fact how we bend space-time.
We've projected our religious, you know, perimeters in an expanding sense that a lot of people now, it's outer space. And so the things that used to be angels and poltergeist are now things from outer space. But in reality, it's whatever it is that's at the fringe of our belief system. And I think that the popularity of the extraterrestrial hypothesis, let's not forget, the first UFO classical flying saucer shape appeared in the covers of Astounding Science Fiction in the 1920s.
No, actually, the first flying saucer descriptions appeared in the ancient Sumerian records and
back
in the Bible.
I'm talking about the image of that word, you know, of the type that we have, the first pictorial representation that we have.
I think you'll find it in the pyramids.
Okay, but I'm just saying that the science fiction literature has colored our impression of what the limits of our consciousness are, and that's tended to color our interpretation of what these unknowns are. We sort of project part of our spiritual thirst for the ultimate
I think that's very true in effect,
in
what you're saying.
My mother saw a UFO long before that, and
yeah,
no effect whatsoever on that.
Sure,
sure.
You know, there was quite a phenomenon here that happened about 100 years ago, a little over 100 years ago. It was called the great spaceship thing, and it floated from Sacramento all the way up to Chicago.
Indeed, they saw airships back then.
And it looked kind of like a Jules Verne ship. Now, that's just what the consciousness of the people, they couldn't fathom anything else other than that back in the mid-1800s, and so that was the way the description of it came out.
That's exactly what I mean.
But it was seen by, you know, tens of thousands of people.
That shows how literature and illustrations of the time tend to color people's projections of what,
mm-hmm.
what may not quite be real. Reality we're familiar with suddenly appears, and we tend to sort of color it with what we.
But now we have photographs.
Things should be
there.
But these photographs are no good. You don't see very many really good photographs.
I don't know where you've been.
I haven't seen any really unambiguous photographs that couldn't be faked.
Well, I'm going to have to put a display up here one of these days.
Well, a lot of these UFOs are halfway between a energy and a physical state, a plasma, and. They're very hard to photograph. They're very fuzzy. You can't get beyond that.
There's no way you can get it. The hypothesis that I mentioned would tend to make them not very photogenic, as you describe it. I just tend to think that that should be a direction that people should start making an effort to carry cameras with them and
they should,
sort of not tell people so that the future is deprived of the knowledge of where you're going to be. You might be able to sneak up on them that way.
I appreciate your call, Don. And by the way, you're right on target with a lot of the hypothesis of many of the physicists that are working on this case, that we are looking at a form of space travel and interdimensional type of apparatus, which is very difficult for us to understand all of that. But we can see them fading in and out of this dimension at times. In fact, we have a series of photographs that shows them fading right in and out of where we are.
Well, the people in the future are going to outnumber the past, those of the present, just like we do with the past. So there's going to be a lot of people someday who will be historians, and they'll be curious to look back into the past, and I'm sure that they're looking over at dinosaurs and at the molten lavas of a billion years ago. But now, right now, we're probably, it won't be too long until we'll invent those things. We'll invent that means. And when we do, then it'll be a very different world then. I think that there are implications to this hypothesis that are very, very fruitful. And we've seen a lot of metaphysical nonsense about UFOs and space people and spaceships that has tended to make UFO study a little bit less than respectable in many
right,
accounts.
Definitely.
So I think that, you know, it's kind of a stagnant way to go of the extraterrestrial hypothesis, and it needs some new life in the subject.
Well, I appreciate your input.
Bye-bye.
I think you're on a good one there, Don. Thank you very much for that. I'm Bill Jenkins. It's Open Mind. We're talking different and perhaps better dynamics into this matter of the UFO. We have another Don on the line. Don, number two, welcome aboard.
Hi, Bill.
Yeah.
Hi, John. How are you doing tonight?
Oh, I'm fine. Thank you.
I have a couple of things to relate to you that you might be interested in. In this month's issue, the July issue of Modern Photography, they have a short article in there about a Norwegian young man who was out working outside of his house, and he saw a UFO, and he ran back in, and the only thing he had available was a little Kodak disc camera, one of the new ones.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And he ran out there, and he got a couple of shots of it and everything. But a Norwegian newspaper did a major article on that, a two-page spread, along with the pictures on the front page. And the Norwegian Air Force examined the little diskette and said there wasn't any tampering of any type with the little exposures. And so they put their stamp of approval that it was authentic. But then the diskette has been forwarded on to NASA.
Goodbye.
Yeah.
That'll be the end of it.
Well, when exactly this occurred, they didn't state, because they just put it in modern photography because it happened to bring up the cameras, see? And the sales of little Kodak disc cameras over in Norway went up after that.
Good.
The only way he'll get that diskette back is through the Freedom of Information Act, and they'll have it tacked to that somewhere. Meanwhile, there'll be another report saying that it was nothing.
Yeah,
seen that happen too many times.
I wanted to bring up, you had a guest on a few years ago, Bill, that it was because of that guest. He was talking about UFOs, and I don't recall who it was, whether it was Hynek or maybe even the Gladdens. But it recalled an event that occurred many years ago when I was 15 years old, back in 1952. And I had completely forgotten it until your guest was on the show.
Mm-hmm.
And I was headed for New York on a Greyhound bus. I got on at L.A. here. And I had a young man sitting next to me. I was 15. He must have been about 22 or 23 years old. And clean-cut looking kid. He was on his way back to Ohio. And he was on leave, but he was wearing civilian clothes. So we did a little chit-chatting back and forth and whatnot, and I told him things that were interesting me at 15, and he talked about different things. But somehow we got on the subject of astronomy and other things, and I happened to ask him somewhere along the line, what did he think about these flying saucers, see?
They were getting to be very big then.
Yeah, so we bantered it back and forth, see, but then he said, there's something, he said, I can tell you. He said, but it would freak you out. And I come back to that every once in a while in a conversation.
What did he tell you that freaked you out?
He wouldn't. He wouldn't tell me. He'd get very agitated, very solemn. But he was stationed at a base in Ohio. And if I remember correctly, that's back there where that Hangar 18 was at.
Sounds like it might have been right there.
He might have known something.
He was an MP there. See, but I kept pressing on that. And he would get agitated, but he wouldn't tell me. He would just say, there's something I can tell you, but it would just freak you out. And I never found out what
he had
meant by that. But when we hit, ordinarily, when we hit...
John, do you happen to have that guy's name?
I sure don't. I'll tell you this, Bill. I'm going to finish this up here. Ordinarily, we would have transferred and gone our separate ways at Chicago. I'd have gone on to New York, and he'd have transferred over to a bus for Ohio. But we hit a stopover at Kansas City and got off for a rest stop. We got back on. He wasn't on that bus. I mean, I was used to talking to this guy all the way. And all of a sudden, he's not on the bus at Kansas City. He didn't get back on. That seat was empty.
Well, that was a very unusual time in the early
50s. It was, see? And there weren't any cults or anything else back in those days. And there wasn't a lot of information around about it. But I had that curiosity, but I just kept probing at him. Every once in a while, I didn't bear down too hard, but I looped the conversation back. But he would come to that same point. I'd like to tell you, but I cannot tell you. But he'd say it would freak you out.
During that period, the late 40s to the early 50s, Wright-Patman Air Force Base and Edwards Air Force Base, that was the center of all UFO studies that the government was engaged in at that time.
Well, it's now been
extended to all over. But,
the thing I'm thinking now, Bill, is if this fella is out there now and he hears this show, he could prove that he was on that bus with me because only he knows the month that he was on that bus and that I was on there with him. That's the one thing. He could call in and say, hey, I was on that bus with a young fellow, and it was this month and this week.
Well, if you were on the bus, guy.
If you ever get a chance to contact him, I'd sure like to hear from him.
I'd like to have him call into the show if he's listening to this.
1952.
Now you know what I couldn't tell you.
All right.
And that's the year the CIA had their meeting and decided to ridicule UFO reports.
Right.
Most people don't know about that.
I didn't remember that, Bill, until you had somebody on there, and I never put the pieces together.
That sounds like I may have had Bill Moore on at the time.
And that whole thing came back to me.
All right.
I mean, that was 1952 when I was 15, and now I'm 48, and all of a sudden, you know, a couple of years ago, it came right back up to me. This is what this young fellow was trying to tell me, but he couldn't. Yeah.
He may have very well had the skinny on something there. Don, thank you very much for your call.
Bill.
Appreciate that very much.
Okay, take care.
I'm Bill Jenkins. We're talking UFOs tonight with John D. Herrera. Listen, Tony, you want some hard evidence? What's on your mind?
Hi, fellas. My questions for your guests are these. Number one, I'd like to know what his process of verification is. For example, with the Van Nuys man who claimed that he saw this this intelligent ball of light, I mean, a man reports that. Do you simply take his word for that?
No, absolutely not. There's so many other cases, though. I read everything I can find on that subject. The technical libraries are full of cases such as that.
People that have reported that particular kind of incident.
Right.
Okay. And the other thing is, do you contend that a big city newspaper reporter has either never seen one of these UFOs or has had the story squashed by his editor?
What are you saying?
Well, what I'm saying is that why in the world let's take a guy like Jack Nelson from the L.A. Times or really any reporter.
I believe it was in the 60s the government decided to hire Arthur Godfrey to do some radio spots debunking UFOs. And before they got started on that, Arthur Godfrey encountered a UFO while flying across the country on his own plane. And that killed it.
I might bring up something else to you, Tony, who there was a gentleman who wasn't exactly a Jack Nelson of the Los Angeles Times, but who saw the UFO along with a group of other men. They were at a church function, in fact, and he reported that and gave a detailed description of that to MUFON, in fact, and signed his name to it, and was really going to have this investigated as he was running for the presidency of the United States. And when Jimmy Carter became the president of the United States, after he had trumped about this for so long, then all at once he became very, very quiet about this matter of the UFO.
Okay. I wonder if, Bill, when the...
You want to hang on there, Tony? There's our little orchestra.
Okay. Would you relate the New York and England incidents?
Okay. We'll get into that right after the news.
Thank you.
Tony had asked us about the situation in England and also in northern New York. Very briefly, we have a case that started last year at an American Air Force base, which borders onto an RAF base up there. And I forget, I want to say Bretton Woods, but that's not it. But it's in north central England. Because it is American territory, Freedom of Information Act has been able to pull documentation, the official reports that have come out of the Air Force on that case. There was a landing. There was contact with officers at the base, with those that were on board. Initially, it may have been a malfunctioning of that spacecraft, but a number of military personnel were able to see that. There is a book now being written about the incident that the information...
Who's the author of that, though?
I don't know offhand. I know that Larry Fawcett was working on it, and Alan Hynek was working on it. Now, whether they were working on the book, they were certainly working on the information. Which is, I suppose if you really wanted to get a lot of the information, you could contact the Center for UFO Studies in Phoenix. Do you have that number handy?
Yes, I do. I've worked with the center for many years.
Why don't you give them that number, and they'll be glad to send you all of the information they can.
Certainly.
All right.
Dr. Hynek was with the Air Force for 25 years investigating UFOs. And that was not a serious effort. They couldn't get the funding they needed.
Well, he was a classical skeptic when he started.
Right, definitely. So it's possible there were other groups in the government that were doing some serious UFO work. Certainly the NSA has five times the funding the CIA has, and they could afford to do a little of that.
Everything that you touch has their imprimatur on it,
definitely.
It seems about. But what is Dr. Hynek's number for people who want to know more about the English?
I have to dig through my billfold.
Now you dig through that. The other incident was the Brewster, New York incident, which happened last summer. And in fact, there were television pictures that were even shown here in Los Angeles of that, where thousands of people who lived in upstate New York around Brewster. Now, this is a sow's ear area. We're not talking about illiterate farmers out on the field somewhere. These were business executives of all different kind, people of great stature as far as having some smarts about them is concerned. And this great skeletal type craft appeared for many nights in a row, lighted, hovering, moving very, very slowly over the area. It stopped traffic on the throughways up there, in fact, as people would stop and just watch this thing move around. It always came at night, Now, during this, there were some pranksters that got into their light airplanes and started flying in formation at night and trying to kick up a little storm, but they grounded them for a while, but they had no reason to ground them, so they let them fly some more, but there are two different things. They had a village meeting in Brewster, New York, where 1,200 people attended it, and these were residents of the area that live in the very expensive homes. 800 of them were eyewitnesses to the event. It cannot be attributed to just the little guys running around in their light planes trying to jostle the folks up. And as I recall, it started around March and went on through June and July of last year. And that wasn't the first time it had happened. It had happened a couple of years before.
Definitely. There were more than 800 people that reported seeing UFOs there around New York. And there was quite a controversy over whether it was the private planes that were causing all of these. It's possible we had both.
Well, private planes have a hard time flying at 4 and 5 miles an hour and hovering, which hundreds of witnesses reported seeing. They didn't see as...
probably the slowest Cessna with STOL equipment to be about 40 or 45
in
miles
a good
per
headwind.
Hour. Yeah, a good headwind, certainly.
But something very definitely
but
went on.
But it couldn't make a sharp turn or do anything like that.
The things that happened. And here was an incident where it was seen by thousands of people.
Certainly.
And they all were not having mass hysteria at the same time or mass hallucinations of exactly the same order. And but a very little official attention was paid to it. The FAA said that they're not violating any of their regulations, so they're not interested. NASA people came up and said nothing. Other government people came up and just watched. But that was about it. And nobody knows what that was all about or what they was doing. And then they went away, I think, in August.
Well, that's the way it always happens with these UFOs. They just fade away.
Come do their thing.
Right.
All right. John, you're on the line. Can we help you?
Yes, I have two questions.
All right.
What is exactly bending time? What happened?
Bending space-time.
Bending space-time.
Space warps is what he's probably talking about.
I think that's it, yeah.
Yeah. Well, we know that with Einstein's work, that the higher the velocity, slower the time, and there can be space warps and so forth in this time, variation of time.
Uh-huh. Does the clock slow down?
Right.
So what?
There was a very interesting little program on Channel 11 last night about time travel. They were also promoting that new movie.
Could it be possibly a time illusion?
Well, no, I tell you, it's a little bit more complicated than that, but let me point you to July 27th when Tom Bearden will be here, who is probably one of the nation's leading theoretical physicists, and he will explain bending space-time because it's very important to understand how we're having our weather controlled at the moment on it. But you must remember that time, and even space, as far as that goes, distance from one point to another, is something that we have manufactured in our mind to satisfy the needs of our five senses so that we can cope with the reality of the world that we live in. But there is a lot more to the reality of the world we live in than time. And time actually doesn't exist except to us. It's a local phenomenon for our unevolved selves, if you want to put it that way.
Yeah. Not material.
If you were to give you an example of how you could bend space-time and how perhaps a lot of these this traveling is done from, you know, great distances, we have the notion that you can't travel faster than the speed of light. Well, we know that that's not true anymore. But
particles,
that you won't do that.
Violating that.
All the time. Yeah. I saw some experiments the other day where electromagnetic waves were shooting out at about 8 times the speed of light. But if you wanted to, if you imagine a piece of paper in your hand, right, and you're at point A, which is at one corner, and on the opposite corner of the paper is point B, and let's say that's 500 light years across there as we reckon things. And the best we could do, it would take us 500 years to get there if we could travel at the speed of light, right? But if you simply fold that piece of paper where the two points come together, you could get from point A to point B in a microsecond.
Definitely.
And that's bending space-time.
Space-time.
Does that help you?
Kind of, yeah.
All right. Don't ask me to go much deeper than that, John, because we'll let Mr. Durkin get into that when he's here on the 27th.
Another question.
Mm-hmm.
I called you earlier this year about fighting us over L.A.
Mm-hmm.
And do you remember that? I called on a Monday morning.
Could you go over that briefly? Go over it again, then.
Yeah.
You called me in the newsroom?
Yeah.
Okay.
And went very slowly, I thought for about 15 minutes, two nights in a row at 1:30 in the morning. I was just wondering if anything had ever come of that.
I do remember that now, John. I did bring that information to Alan Hynek's attention that very morning, in fact.
Uh-huh.
And I think he had some of his people working on it. I must tell you, I haven't got any feedback from Alan on that.
Well, I couldn't see it. It was cloudy the next night. It was cloudy the next night.
Yeah.
But it was really strange. I saw the same exact thing two nights in a row.
That is strange. However, Southern California is a volatile area.
So I'm glad I got it on the air, so in case someone saw it.
All right. Well, I'd like to, if somebody saw it, too, they'd get back to us.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
All right, John. Thank you very much. I'm Bill Jenkins. It's Open Mind. We're talking flying saucer. Remind you of something that's coming up beginning October 12th. We're all going to London. You, I, everybody that wants to go as a part of the KABC Travel Club. Going to spend a week over there. And it's a great way and an inexpensive way for you to go to London. And while we're over there, we're going to visit some of the famous ghost houses in London. We'll travel up to Stonehenge. We will be with some of London's famous mediums. We are trying to arrange, and I think we will be able to meet with Lord Kilkenny and of the House of Lords and then give us a briefing on the Parliament's investigation into the UFO phenomenon. And we're going to have a grand time, and you're invited to go as a part of the KABC Travel Club. Chucky Travel, who handles all of that, has made some great arrangements for us over there. We have almost a whole hotel to ourselves. Took a while to get that because the dollar was so strong in England that all the hotel rooms were full. So we had to put it off to October where we could get a large enough block. Now, if you'd be interested in finding out about what it takes to get there, and I assure you that it'll be the most inexpensive way you could ever go to London and have some open mind fun along the way, why don't you drop me a line? Just send it to Bill Jenkins, London Trip, KABC. That's at 3321 South La Cienega Boulevard. I'll get that over to Chucky Travel. His group will contact you, and then away we are. And I would like for as many of us to go as possible. You know, Ken and Bob's always taking people everywhere, but we have the open mind bunch. We know how to have fun. We can have fun on all levels. We'll outdo them. And I'd like to have you come along with us. It's October 12th, and if you've got a week available then and want to go with us over to London, we'd like to have you go. So just write me, give me your name, address, and telephone number, and how we can contact you, and then you work it out with Chucky Travel, and he'll make it very easy for you. Okay, we have Rosendo on the line. Hello.
Hello, Bill. Hello, Mr. Herrera.
Hi.
In the classes that I took at the university, they dogmatically insisted that things were a certain way, and thanks to you, Bill, on bringing all these programs, I have stimulated my thinking into knowing that other things are possible. And my question to you, Mr. Herrera, is simple. It was reported on the wire that there was a city, 120-some buildings, some on 15 stories high, found out in Peru somewhere, close to the spaceport that's up in the mountains there.
At the Nazca Plains, yes.
You're right. Have you gotten any information on that as to how long that city's been down there or what?
No, I read the same thing just recently, a couple days ago, I believe.
Yeah, so
I'd like to get more information on that.
That's not Machu Picchu, right?
No, it's supposed to be the largest city ever found.
Yeah, they reported something like 120 buildings already.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, anyway, thank you very much, and thanks for bringing this information to us, Bill. It's I really appreciate it. I'm beginning to know that there's something else out there that the books didn't tell me about.
Well, that's right. There's a lot of it, and there I thank you for the information. I hadn't heard about the big city. We may make that another open mind trip. We'll go down to Peru.
Thank you. Have a nice evening.
And check that out. Thank you, Rosendo.
Yes,
glad to have you aboard. All right, Jim, you're on.
Okay, Bill. I just called. I'm a pretty skeptical person myself. And I have a relative who's a general officer in the service. He's retired now.
Mm-hmm.
And he worked at the Pentagon, and he did work to some extent with the UFO question.
Mm-hmm.
And we were sitting around in the backyard one night just kind of shooting the breeze, and we started kidding him around about little green men and this kind of thing. And he got very serious, and he said, it's no joke. He said, they actually exist, and we know they're not from this planet. We have parts of the vehicle detailed drawings, and we're incorporating some of the aerodynamic designs in future aircraft. He said, I can't say anything more than that. In fact, he said, I probably said too much already. And the reason the service and NASA and all these other companies don't, or organizations don't come out and make any statements is because they don't want to alarm people and start a media circus. That's what they claim.
Well, no, they don't want to upset the bureaucratic apple cart and
well, I'm sure that's part of it.
Contracts taken away from
too, there'd be all kinds of ramifications. But this relative is a very conservative person, and he's not at all the type of person that would make those kind of statements. Unless they're true.
But you get a lot of military people saying similar things.
Yeah, so there's no doubt in my mind that they exist. There's no doubt in my mind that we have parts of the flying machines or whatever they are, probably at places like Wright Pat. I know there are some facilities in Virginia where they have a lot of the documentation, photos, this kind of thing, and
Langley
also they have flight recorder tapes, too.
Langley Field, they call it the Space Museum now.
Yeah, that could be it, but I know they also have flight tapes from the pilots and this kind of thing, too. So, I don't know, there's no, you know, as far as the, I think we should call them IFOs, identified flying objects, because there's no question in my mind that they're out there, and the only reason that I hung on was that I just wanted to sort of verify what y'all are saying, that anybody who's skeptical about it, they could put their mind at rest.
Well, I thank you very much for that, Jim, and your relative really did touch upon a sensitive part as far as the government is concerned, and that is the conversion of what they have found out into modern-day hardware.
Yeah, that's right. The thing is this, Bill, I realize, you know, with a situation like this where it's like anonymous calls and everything, that the kooks can't call in, but
we try, you know.
Believe me, I'm very serious, and this relative of mine is a career military man, and as I say, he's very conservative, and he doesn't make these kind of statements, and I was really shocked when he started talking about it.
Would he like to talk off the record, totally off the record?
Well, I really doubt that he would. It's the old bugaboo, you know, about worrying something might happen or something of this sort.
Brady loses retirement or something.
Yeah, you know, there's a million reasons, and by his nature that he is very conservative, it probably would extend to something like this, too. But I just thought I'd mention it because, of course, those people who believe it will always believe it, and those who don't won't.
Definitely.
But there's no question in my mind that it's true.
Well, I appreciate that, and I appreciate your relative who was in the Air Force, and certainly so many of the Air Force people know that all of this is true.
Yeah.
We're seeing more and more of them speak up now as time goes by, and they see the total impropriety of government in hiding this, as they have in the past. I think
well,
we're caught in a bureaucratic quagmire.
I'm just sorry I can't be more explicit, Bill, but because I know it sounds, you know, a little vague in a way, but it is the absolute truth.
They're real, absolutely.
Yeah,
thank you so much.
I thank you very much
really
for that input, and it's good to know. See?
And if the skeptics still have their $10,000 offer, they can just contact me.
Yeah, you want
I'm ready to go.
You ready? Want to take on the skeptics?
Why are they running from me?
Yeah, there they are, just running away. They don't want to get into it because all you have to do to take their $10,000 is to give them a long list of things that
right.
are available from the federal government now through the Freedom of Information Act that puts a great deal of validity.
I threw in ghosts and apparitions, so they would be sure to take me up on it, but.
That's too easy to prove.
Run and hide.
All right, I'm Bill Jenkins with John D. Herrera. We'll be back. And you're certainly invited to talk. We have a few lines open. Let me give you the numbers if you want to get in.
John?
Good evening.
Good evening. I'm kind of interjecting not an opposing viewpoint, just kind of a different perspective.
Welcome aboard. Let's have it.
Okay. There's been a lot of brain research done on the holographic model. Are you familiar with it, Bill?
To some degree, yes.
What's happening is there's a lot of different frequencies that are being interpreted by our senses, our five senses, and then they're transformed. But when, let's say, like they hit the eye, they're transformed into optical light or like light waves, and then the brain does a Fourier transform and turns it into an objective pattern, brainwave pattern, which is transmitted to the cortex of the brain. And it what we're visualizing is, because the eye is a receptor, we're visualizing on the back of our brain, on the visual cortex, a neural pattern, a three-dimensional neural pattern. We're not seeing the outside world. And so the thing is that they believe that what's a part of the holographic part of it, the whole is what we're perceiving in our mind with the hologram, the photographic plate there's a timeless dimension. And what when we're talking about outer space, what we're possibly could be perceiving is a dimension inside of our mind. Would you like to comment on that?
Well, let me sort of figure out in my own mind what you were trying to say. Our mind is a computer, and it's set to a certain reality. And it receives information visually, let's say, that's transformed into electromagnetic signals that the little static discharges in our mind can understand. And the computer says, oh, that means this. And then that's what we end up seeing. Did that simplify it?
It's an alternate reality, I guess.
It's a representation.
Right.
And so the thing is that what people are seeing, what they're saying is that the holographic plate, the part, if any little piece is broken off the holographic in the holographic picture, the whole picture is contained in that little part. And what the thing is that what each person is common to each person is the content of our mind, that holographic reality. And so what people, what type of energies that people are and belief systems that are today are being projected into this. In other words, we can read out of this holographic reality or this model and see reality by what everybody is viewing as reality at this point in time. Like this, the other man, Don, I believe, said that these people that are in the future, this space bending of space-time, they're looking back at us.
Mm-hmm. That doesn't explain, though, how the camera picks these things up also. You know, it doesn't have its little computer up there. It's just going to give us a picture of what it sees.
Correct. And if
this
reality is affected by things in your past, then different individuals would have different realities, whether slightly different at least. In our reports, are very consistent. People see the same type of thing. We have sometimes hundreds or thousands of people visualize a UFO, and the sightings are, descriptions are the same.
It would be beyond coincidence, I think, if you had 1,000 witnesses, and of course you've had that many, many times, and they all are describing basically the same thing. Now, we know that they'll probably describe it a little different, like you and I would describe the same automobile accident if we both were to witness it. They're slightly different, but
mm-hmm.
it would be basically the same thing.
We basically see the same reality.
Right.
I see.
But it's a good notion, and I certainly don't want to put it down, because a lot of that does happen in the mind. Your mind translates some things that it can see that it doesn't understand, and tries to simplify that into something that it does understand. And I think a classic example of that would be the account that Ezekiel wrote about his encounter with a UFO. Now, this was totally outside of his consciousness, what he was seeing. And
he didn't have any technical background for describing
Didn't have any background. He was
wheel upon a wheel and so forth.
He was a very good reporter, as it turns out.
Yes, he did.
Reporting what he saw the best he knew how to saw it, but the best that he saw it. And everything that he saw just defied anything that he knew could possibly exist.
Plus, his interpretation's been translated several times and
mm-hmm.
probably changed in the translation.
This was the chariot that he saw.
Right.
The wheel within the wheel. And he actually saw guys come out of the spacecraft and land with backpacks on. Saw the ships land, heard the ships talking to the people on the ground, giving command. And he was actually able to see the commander of the ship sitting up there in his throne. He called it a throne. He didn't know anything else. It was a great big chair like we have on a space shuttle.
Certainly. That's one of the finest ancient sightings.
Well, how about that the field of energy at that point in time where he was or where anybody else is conducive to being able to perceive? In other words, he may be able to perceive that the energy at that point in time would be such that he would be looking into the future.
Well, it's hard to say what kind of energy field was doing him around. It certainly flattened him out for a while.
We don't know anything about UFO energies.
Yeah.
Speculate. We're learning a little.
Ezekiel did talk about the fire as if it were a rocket of using a propellant, as we understand things. And a lot of the ancient accounts show rockets that were belching fire, much like
the one I saw. Really didn't look like a chemical fire or something you'd see behind a rocket. More like maybe electrical ionized propulsion.
Yeah.
It was weird.
An ionized field or a plasma.
It was colorful, though. There was several colors.
Well, how about the thing of the illusions that exist in our life, where we are looking through our eye, but if that image is upside down because of the curvature of our eye, the concave curvature of our eye inverts the image that's coming in.
And it gets right back up again when it gets back into the rod.
We would have problems with the
see, what are we really seeing? What are we actually
not just
seeing?
UFOs.
Pardon me?
We would have difficulties with other things, not just UFOs.
I'm sure if you stood in my backyard, Mark, and looked at the willow tree that I have back there, and I'm looking at it too, I'm standing beside you, we're basically seeing the same thing.
Yeah.
All right, Mark?
Okay.
All right.
All right. Thank you
very much.
Bye-bye.
But that is a good point. We do sort of, if we cannot understand the information that we're getting, whether it's visual or whatever, we will try to accommodate it.
We do, definitely.
As best we can. We have Paul on the line. Hello, Paul.
Hi, Bill.
Mm-hmm.
I have two questions to ask Mr. Herrera.
Yes.
But firstly, let me say I'm a total skeptic.
Welcome aboard. Glad to have you here.
All right. Thank you. Your program.
Are you willing to...
Your program is very interesting. My first question is this.
Right.
In your knowledge, have these objects ever been observed objectively? Most of the information I hear about is anecdotal, with the exception of so-called photographic evidence. In other words, have there ever been radar reflections noted or spectroscopic observations or... magnetometer observations. In other words...
You get me the equipment, I'll be out there tonight.
Beg pardon?
I'm still trying to get my hands on proper equipment to get out there myself with spectrographs and whatever.
Well, you say the government has been involved there's a freedom of information business going on. Is there evidence that this type of device has been used?
Yes, indeed. Yeah, there is. Bill Moore was with us here about 2 months ago.
Bill has a lot of the documents.
With a whole new body of information of the Air Force intelligence that they had gained over many, many years, and it goes into great detail about the testing that they used, the material that was used, the equipment that was used, and the conclusions that were drawn from that. Yes, there has been very scientific analysis of the phenomenon. Phenomenon, I think, is a wrong word. It's
phenomena is.
Yeah, it really is. It is the wrong word, but there has been extensive scientific study that is rather conclusive in the fact that they are not ours, and they are not from another country, and that they are terribly unnatural. And that comes right up. That's from the federal government.
But what we do have is photon reception.
Right.
In other words, there are actually photons.
Plus hearing and touch.
Beg pardon? Taste.
Plus our hearing and our touch, our tactile sensory.
There is tactile taste. Sensory perception?
Taste.
All right, my second question is this. How come none of the observatories in California... I have in mind Mount Wilson, Mount Hamilton, and Palomar have never made an observation of this type.
They have made. Astronomers, two separate polls that I can think of found that 5% of astronomers had seen UFOs. And
they've never been reported in any of the astronomical journals.
Just try. I'll get you some good reports and see if you can get them in there, okay? Some very good reports.
Yeah, remember, too, particularly a place like Mount Palomar, they are involved in deep space research. That time is leased, and it's well in advance, and if they're going to watch this galaxy, for instance, that's a far, far away, they have waited a long time to take their photographs and do their study, and they're not really interested in anything else. The only time they really see something is happens to cross over while they're taking a picture.
That is correct.
That happened.
What about Mount Hamilton?
They're involved in the same thing.
Well, they're not doing deep space work.
But they have a specific task
that
the astronomers
true.
Are involved
that is,
in.
That is true.
They can't even see our shuttle and satellites with their telescopes. They're focused so many light years away, there's no way they could see a UFO.
Point of the discussion is that you are telling me that purely objective measurements have been made?
Yes.
Huh.
There are tons of radar blips, if you want to look at those, that are available.
Really?
Yes.
Yeah, there really are.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
Okay, Paul?
I didn't know that.
Oh, yes.
Thank you.
I think one of the most dramatic of the radar pulses was the flap that came over Washington, D.C. Radar showed them. Doing very, very strange. 1952, doing very, very strange maneuvers, and that caused the Air Force to totally scramble because of the radar pulses.
Well, it's been classified. The CIA in 52 decided to ridicule reports, and the Air Force came out with a regulation saying the only reports released are those that could be explained as natural phenomenon, and that's been the policy.
And prior to that, the government was pretty open about it.
These documents are available if you'd like to view them.
They're easy to get. You just have to know which ones to ask for, and if you want to know which ones, write me, and I'll make sure that you get the right codes so that they have to send them to you, because, you see, as a citizen of the country, you own those reports. And they have to give them to you. Okay, Paul?
Yeah, thank you. You've really aroused my curiosity now.
Good. That's what we're all about, and I'm delighted I've done it. Thank you so much
thank
for calling
you.
In.
Good night. Yep.
I'm Bill Jenkins. With me, John D. Herrera. It's Open Mind. A group of people who are very serious about separating the wheat from the chaff about UFO sightings, UFO reports, and what they mean to all of us. And we're open to you to talk to John about the UFO, like Eileen. What's on your mind?
Well, I've been a UFO buff since 1954, and no one can tell me that they have not appeared. They've been seen all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
I feel sorry that there are so many people with closed mind who only believe that the intelligence exists only on Earth. With a vast amount of space and universe, I could never believe this. I might tell you that I have, while I was waiting, I pulled out a letter from my file, which was written by Robert Kennedy on May 9th, 1968.
Mm-hmm.
And he states his interest in UFO and hopes that the government will pursue the investigation further, which he carried a card with this association, and I still am carrying the same card today. What I believe that maybe also what people do not recognize is that the flying saucers and those who are propelling them or whatever are so highly evolved that they can materialize and dematerialize at will. That's why they might see them for a moment, and then they think that they're traveling at thousands of miles or whatever.
Well, I don't know whether they dematerialize or not, but they certainly can cloak them.
I really think they do, Bill. I think she's right on hitting the nail on the head there.
Yeah.
I'm glad that you agree, because that has been my thought for so long, and I was just wondering what your thoughts were along those lines.
I don't know if they can become a nuts and bolts spacecraft, but they can manipulate a plasma and take various shapes. They can expand in size and contract and so forth. That's very definite.
It's a science we have great difficulty in.
We're struggling to do just
deal
that.
Deal with. Unless you're on the outer limits of, as some of our scientists are, and they have certainly learned a lot from the
fusion energy. We'd like to be able to control a plasma.
Mm-hmm.
We know it magnetically. We could control it, but we just can't seem to build the equipment to do this.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you got to remember that we are dealing with what some of the physicist friends that I have and am associated with, we have built a technology on the garbage of science, and we're just now beginning to find out what real science, pristine science, is all about. And we've wasted a lot of technological time in what we have done. And now we're beginning to understand a little bit about what they're doing, because they've gotten down to the real thing. Okay, Eileen?
Well, yes, and I think that there are people as well that can materialize and dematerialize
as
well.
We have a lot of examples of that.
Yes.
I have some photographs I'd like to show you sometime.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you very much, Eileen. Appreciate that call. It's Open Mind tonight. John D. Herrera. We're talking about the UFO. Herrera, And Edison is on the line right now. Edison, welcome aboard.
Okay.
Or Edson it is.
Edson, yes.
Hi, Edson.
How are you? Good evening, Mr. Jenkins.
Hi,
Mr. Herrera. First, I'd like to mention this coming July the 10th is the anniversary, the 129th birth anniversary of Nikola Tesla.
Yes, it is.
Did so much for...
My favorite eccentric and genius.
Well, interestingly enough, Ryan Aircraft in the 1960s was working on a saucer-shaped aircraft that was supposed to use Tesla coils as a propulsion unit. I don't know if you know about that, but what I wanted to ask was about the alleged abduction of two women in Tujunga, California in the 1950s by UFO. Have you heard about that?
There's a book out, Tujunga Canyon Contacts. Is this by Andrew Ruffel? Is this the case you're talking about?
Yes. I don't know that much about it, but I wondered if you could comment on it.
I don't know a lot about it. I know Ann Druffel very well, and she asked me to hypnotize one of these gals. In fact, I tried hypnotizing both of them. One of them failed and couldn't get her to concentrate.
Yes, I understand that Tujunga, in the American Indian language, the area meant place of the Tujunga. No one knows what Tujunga meant, so perhaps there were UFOs back then. Also, have you heard any reports about being in Iowa a couple of years ago?
Right off, I don't recall anything.
Yes, it was an Omni magazine. And,
that's a heck of a way to get out of doing your show.
That's right. My mother is from that city, and she mentioned to me in 1912 that she saw a cigar-shaped UFO fly over that city. There's a lot of Indian mounds. I wonder if, there's not too much said about the American Indians here in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
and their contact with UFOs. Do you have any information?
I don't have a great deal of knowledge in that.
Well, the people that I know that are rather conversant with the oral history, particularly of the Navajo and the Apache, there is an enormous amount of information that comes from there about the relationship between the Indian and their space brothers. And most of the time, they will pinpoint the home of the space brothers as being Pleiades.
So that's... do they say that they're descended from the space people? Or
yes, they say they're direct descendants, and that one of these days, they'll go back home.
Hmm.
The Pleiades. This is a part of that Indian lore.
Hmm. Interesting. I didn't hear that part about it, but I've heard about the...
You haven't been listening to this show long enough.
Well...
We've gone into this a number of times, yeah.
Well, I wonder if there's any way of... I've seen plans for UFO detectors. Do they really work? Do you know anything about them?
They should. There's various designs. One of the best, better ones utilizes a CRT tube. And
what happens? Does it light up or does it...
The magnetic interference will... change the direction of the beam and trigger a sensor sound an alarm. This will just tell you that something magnetic is disturbing your equipment. And you can get ready with the camera, recorder, and what have you.
One of the leading men in that field, and his name escapes me, he was a guest on the show here a couple of years ago, is down in Missouri. Who was in the physics department at one of the universities. I want to say the University of Missouri, but I don't think so.
Jan Eric Herr down in San Diego builds and sells some of these very sophisticated detectors. Jan Eric Herr.
Diego. We'll try to find Jan's address for you, and if you want to contact him about getting it, a detector, which just detects a disturbance in the magnetic lines of force.
All right.
Mm-hmm.
And that may be anything, but it may be a UFO.
Yeah.
It's a start.
Yeah. Get you in the right direction.
Thank you very much.
Okay, Edson. Thank you very much. And we have Eve on the line. Hello, Eve.
Hello. Before I ask, before I make my skeptic remark.
A skeptic.
A skeptic, yes. Or a partially skeptic, perhaps.
Mm.
Can I ask Mr. Herrera, is that the name correct?
Yes.
Mr. Herrera, do you believe in there are clones being made by our government?
Clones?
Clones, you know.
I don't have any information on that.
Well, I mean, you've heard about that, haven't you? They're making
human clones?
Yes, human clones.
No, I haven't.
Well, I heard this 20 years ago or 10 years ago, and that's another reason why I'm so skeptical. But Mr. Bill Jennings, right?
Jennings.
Mr. Jennings.
Yes.
The reason I'm a skeptic is, first of all this information about the UFOs is only coming in to us, what, since 1940, you said,
1930?
47. What? Where were the UFOs before this?
They were there.
They were there.
The big interest peaked in 47.
But why 47?
My mother saw one long before that. They were around.
Well, anyway, I'm curious, why 47? And the other thing, Mr.
Let us answer that question.
Oh, I'm sorry, I can't hear you too well.
Why 47?
There was a fascinating sighting over Mount Rainier.
Mm-hmm.
And
By Mr. Arnold.
Kenneth Arnold. And that really sparked the imagination.
And one of the reasons for it probably was, if you'll remember, that was just on the heels of a very significant event in Earth evolution. We decided that we knew how to blow ourselves to a jillion pieces and exploded some atomic bombs.
And our television waves were going out into outer space at that time.
And you have to remember when an atomic bomb explodes, as we had exploded three at that time, and we're in the process of testing others, you send out an E-field, which is can go, you know, throughout the cosmos, and that's a signature to somebody that, there's bad business going on over there. We should go check it out.
Can I make replies to these things?
Yeah, you can. But I tell you what, you're going to have to wait because we're just a little behind time. We've got to stop for newscast. You want to hang on here?
Sure, I'd love to. Would you let me?
Sure.
Thank you.
We'll be right back.
I'm the first caller.
I'm Bill Jenkins. It's Open Mind. Jenkins, this Saturday night, we're talking the UFO. And with me, John D. Herrera, who has been investigating these for a long time, working with MUFON and APRO, two of the leading organizations, working with Dr. J. Allen Hynek at the Center for UFO Studies in Phoenix. And if you have questions about it, or if you're a skeptic like Eve, who was on the line when we had to abort there for a moment. Eve, are you still with us?
Still here.
All right.
May I finish what I wanted to say? I was listening to your program for the first time, and I decided to call in and tell you my point of view because I listened to yours. I heard you speak of Ezekiel, and I've read Ezekiel, and I some of the things you say are true, but some of the things you, the way you interpret Ezekiel, I do not. Also, I do believe in angels, which in Genesis, they speak of angels, and they speak of angels coming down as men to visit Abraham, but not in plasmic or whatever you call this, microplasmic or whatever bodies.
No, if you get back to the etymology of the... of the words. The etymology is the root study of words, and we've had Drs. Lee and Vivian Gladden on them many times. And the way those words that were used, particularly in the books that were written by Moses, which is the first five of the books, were not speaking of some sort of mythical character, but actually
living beings.
A living human being.
But angels aren't living human beings.
Or a robot. And in many instances, there were robots, like the ones that were set up to guard the Garden of Eden with their laser beams and with their flashing lights and things. So you have to go a little bit deeper than the English that you're reading in the Bible and get down into the root words of the original text as it came out, and you get a different view of it.
Excuse me, are you saying that the book that Moses wrote were written the way you just said they were? They were not described as human beings, but as...
Some of them were described as human beings.
Human-like.
And human-like.
Human-like.
And some of them were described as
angels,
or as cherubs, or as machines. In fact, the ones that they would fly around in were described.
Like the ones you're talking about in the UFOs? Anything similar to those?
I guess the descriptions aren't good enough to where we could say they were.
In other words,
flying aircraft, yes.
What you're saying is you don't call them human-like. You don't call them at all human-like, do you? I mean, you haven't been calling them human-like. You were saying something about plasma,
yes,
microplasmic. And that's why I don't believe in this, because I know that there are angels, and it's written in Scripture that we are a little lower than the angel. We cannot see the angels, but the angels can see us. Also, I read Ezekiel.
Wait a minute, that's not true. You're not reading your Bible very carefully.
I read it over and over again.
Job and some others had many conversations with angels, and they saw them, and in fact wrestled with them on occasion.
Well, it depends on who's seeing them. I mean, it depends on God, who he wants to see the angels.
Well, you just said. See them. Now you certainly, we have too many references in the Bible where they did see them and talk to them.
But when you were giving the explanation that Moses wrote, I get the feeling that you're saying to me the angels that I speak of that came down in human form are not what Moses wrote. Is that, am I correct? Am I correct in that assumption?
What Moses was talking about were human beings or robots.
They came in human being. They came in human form or in robot form. Is that
actually,
what you
there's
said?
A very, very solid wall of evidence that suggests that Moses was talking
okay,
about human beings.
All right, my last question is this. If these are... Oh, I also believe this. I believe there are UFOs, but not from different parts of the cosmos. I believe that our government's probably making and building and it's secret, top secret stuff. I believe we can build UFOs just like we can these very sharp Air Force planes.
Well, what about the UFOs that were depicted in the ancient writings and in fact in the paintings of the Renaissance that you find all over Europe? Their UFOs were up there long before the United States government was in existence.
Well, that's an ancient writing, but you're saying the first writing we had was in 1947. If we were almost 2,000 years old...
We said that was the beginning UFO discovery.
But Bill, this is
everywhere.
Bill, it's almost 2,000 years, and if they only visit us in 1947, there's something wrong.
No, they
should have visited us sooner than that. That's why I'm a skeptic.
Eve, they've been visiting us all along. We're trying to... Now, listen carefully to what
I
say.
They are depicted
in ancient writings. They are depicted in ancient carvings. They're depicted in the ancient paintings, ancient being thousands of years ago, up to 100 years ago, and 200 years ago, 300 years ago. They are a part of the lore of every culture on this planet, whether it be the Aborigines of Australia or the ancient Chinese or whatever. They're everywhere through all the time periods that we know about. So it didn't just start in 1947.
Well, okay, but I still say I think they're angels, not the UFO people. I still think that they're the higher celestial bodies, higher than us. And
celestial in that they come from someplace other than Earth, but they must be human.
But they can come in human form, whatever the Lord wants them to come in. That's the way I believe. I just don't believe
that's
that
fine.
Other
you
people.
You may be right.
Pardon?
You may be right.
I hope so. And I'd like to see one, really. I really would enjoy seeing one. But it's really funny because so many people see them, and I've traveled everywhere, and I never saw one so far, and I'm a senior citizen. And it's just time to kick the bucket, for me.
Don't feel all by yourself, Eve. I haven't really seen one either.
No, but you walked on hot coals, didn't you?
I did do that. Yes, I did.
Yeah, by the way, I saw that on television the other night,
Robbins hot coals or the skeptics hot coals?
That was Tony Robbins hot coals.
Thank you for listening anyway. Now I'll continue listening to you.
All right, Eve. Thank you for your input. I appreciate it. And let me see. We have Jim here. Hello, Jim.
Hi, gentlemen. I'd like to ask you about the animal mutilations. I recently spoke to a man who was displaced because of economic conditions who was formerly a farmer back east. I unfortunately don't remember the state. He told me that the terrain was quite flat, and obviously, visibility is good. He also stated that within his area, roughly 6 animals a year will disappear, and he stated that this has happened for like the past 15 years that he knows about. Nothing has ever been seen, and from the books that I read, it indicates that the carcasses are left behind. It does not appear to be a dissection as an individual who is interested in learning about the physiology or anatomy of another creature does, but instead, they take specific unusual parts like sex organs, the anus, eyeballs.
I've got some photos of it.
Yeah. Is there any kind of information that you can give me on animal mutilation?
Did you see the film Endangered Species?
No, I haven't.
That was filmed in Colorado, Logan County, and that's one area where they have the most sightings of UFOs, and they find a lot of mutilated cattle.
It does. It'll do very... In those mutilations, by the way, is a terrible word to use there. That's if the doctors at Cedars-Sinai could perform surgery like that, they would be delighted.
Selective dissection might be better than
that. They take out maybe just parts of the immune system, and or just certain parts of the nervous system go out, or they'll take out a heart without cutting the heart open.
The flap started in my hometown. The Snippy, the horse that was reportedly killed by UFO. They saw a UFO late one evening, and Snippy didn't come in. Next morning, they went out looking for him and found him. I guess his brain was missing, and
What's strange is it seems to happen so often that you would think that the knowledge that they are looking for would be acquired and that this would have stopped a long time ago, but it seems to be, at least according to this farmer, ongoing. And that's what seems unusual.
It continues. Last time I went to Colorado, the news reporter there told me that there had been a mutilation, but the sheriff wouldn't tell him where it was at or give him any information on it.
Yeah.
But it continues.
And there is a school of thought that this is a diversionary activity of the CIA to get your mind off of it. You hear all the black helicopters that sometime are associated with the mutilation of these animals, or should we say the surgical work on these animals.
These are supposed to be silent helicopters, and the quietest helicopter we have is the Hughes 500D, and it's still very noisy.
You can still hear it.
Yeah, well, this farmer had stated that nothing had ever been seen, neither have any kind of tracks except for those of the animals been found in the area where the carcasses were. He also stated that it tends to happen in wintertime, which seems kind of strange. You know, and here's an individual who told me he'd been a farmer all his life. Now, this is like Montana or something like that. It's that far back east. It's not as close as Colorado. I don't remember the specific state, though. It could have been the Dakotas.
Oh, they happen all over.
Yeah.
I'll give you another school of thought that a lot of serious attention is being given to about that. It has to do with mineral deposits, of all things. But mineral deposits have a way of working up into the soil if it's down below, whether it is oil or whatever it is. And when an animal eats that grass, for instance, from there is a definite signature within the system of the animal, within its DNA, what it has been eating. And this is one way to literally keep track of the mineral deposits of the planet without covertly going out to Farmer Brown's field and saying, we want to, you know, put a sinkhole in here to see if there's any oil or whatever it may be underneath there, just by getting certain parts of the animal who has been eating the grass there that they can literally
cover the entire plant. Plants lease these minerals from soil, and many of them the plant has no use for, but
they could take the plants instead of killing animals.
So some people say it is an activity of large corporations in conjunction with the government so that they can have a rather good look at just what our resources are without upsetting too many apple carts.
But no real breakthrough then has happened in so far as animal mutilations. I remember for a while that they were talking about satanic cults and things like that, so nobody really has actually seen a UFO.
Another theory says the government, about the time the mutilations really started up, there was the outlawing of the testing of the biological warfare, and maybe our government CIA is out testing toxins.
I've heard a lot about filing Freedom of Information Act requests, and something I wanted to ask you people is how to do it. Is it simply just type out a letter that starts out with the first paragraph, this is a Freedom of Information Act request? Should you have it notarized, or what procedure should be gone through?
It'll probably cost you nowadays. They're collecting for this copying of documents, and you have to be precise about what documents you want.
Yeah, you can't say, give me everything on UFOs. There is an indicator number of all kinds of numbers that you have to just tell them what you want. And the secret, of course, then, or let's put it the game then, is to find out exactly what those numbers are, those locator numbers, so that they can give it to you.
Once information is released, is it easy to go back and get it? I'm thinking in terms of the book Clear Intent, where they did a lot of Freedom of Information Act requests. If I was to write to the government and give these numbers but not state that I read it in the book, do you think I would get the exact same documentation?
That's a good source for you to go to is Larry Fawcett's book on how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And you can certainly pull those numbers that Larry has given you in that book, and you can write Larry and he'll give you some other good numbers that you can get some interesting things, and the same way with Bill Moore.
A while back you mentioned that some of the crash flying saucers technology was being incorporated into present day aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
Do either of you guys think that the government actually has some sort of flying saucer craft, although it must be quite primitive?
I don't know. Bill Moore specializes in that area. He's got an awful lot of information.
I think their interest has been more rather than in airframe, but in propulsion systems, cloaking systems, and even weapon systems, navigational systems, and they have evidently learned some things from that.
Hmm.
All right?
Yeah, thank you very much.
All right, Jim.
Bye-bye.
Appreciate your questions. Good ones on there. I'm Bill Jenkins. We're talking UFOs tonight with John D. Herrera.
Yes, I was wondering, what would be the procedure of the government if an individual was to walk into a restricted area that he shouldn't be in? What would the government do to this individual?
Well, I can give you one restricted area. If you were to go to Area 51, I believe it is, Nellis Air Force Base, the procedure is that you would be found about 200 miles away in a black bag.
Well,
and not live. If you'd gone too far into the restricted area. Otherwise, you'll be in a ditch somewhere in the black bag wondering how you're going to get out of it.
See, an individual related the story to me that he walked into a restricted area some time ago. And the story he gave me seemed like it could be possible. Supposedly the CIA came after him in helicopters and this and that. And they kind of like threatened his life. They made him sign a contract that he would never divulge anything that he saw for the rest of his life. If so, he'd go to prison and he'd probably never make it there. Is that
place?
Yeah, when and where?
He asked me not to say so.
Sounds like it was up in Nevada.
No, it was close to Los Angeles.
All right.
So I was just wondering what the procedures would be. If that was so, then that's kind of messed up about the government.
I tell you what my procedure would be. I would do exactly what they said, because they mean it.
I would, too.
Right, they told him not to say anything, and he really didn't, but he just said a few things.
Well, there are some areas here in the West, certainly in Nevada, and in California, where there is some very, very sensitive things going on.
Mm-hmm.
And the government really doesn't have any recourse about people who happen up on the area.
Yes, this was by accident. It wasn't deliberate.
It's kind of difficult to get into some of those areas by accident. You had to have done something that you knew you weren't supposed to be doing in the first place, because they are well fenced and there's a lot of warning. And if someone comes on anyway, they have to assume that you're coming on because you want to look at what's going on, and they don't want you to look.
Yeah.
And so they take that course of action. And it is so sensitive and so vital to national defense in many areas that they do not play games.
Is it possible that, like, say, this airline that was supposedly blown up by a terrorist bomb from going from Canada to India, I believe?
We don't know about that.
What? Could it? I understand that. But could it be possible that it could have been shot down by a UFO?
Anything is possible, but that doesn't sound like the activities of UFOs. Usually they are not offensive, except they get to be very defensive at times. If you attack them, you may get a little shot back at you.
What if one of our fighters would chase one?
That's happened before,
yeah,
and they lose that battle.
Right.
Yeah, could it be possible that they were to shoot one of our fighters down?
They have.
Not only ours, some of the Russian MiG fighters.
I think the Russians have learned that that's a losing battle also.
And this doesn't come out in the press.
Well, it did, yes. There was a NSA employee that divulged some of this information. He was at a listening post in Florida, and the Cubans detected a aircraft headed towards Cuba, and they scrambled a couple of Russian MiGs and tried to communicate with this object, and they wouldn't respond. So the orders came to shoot this thing down, and instead of shooting the UFO, one of the MiGs exploded suddenly.
Okay.
So this young fellow released this information to the news media, and he got in very serious trouble over it. The FBI came to his house and ordered him to put everything in a bag, and he wouldn't do it.
Okay. That's all I want to know.
Okay, Joe. Thank you very much for that. And Larry, hello.
Hello, Mr. Jenkins?
Yes.
Yes, Mr. Herrera.
Yes.
Are you familiar with the Trevor James Constable that wrote The Cosmic Pulse of Life?
Uh-huh.
What are your assessment of his pictures?
Well, I take them seriously. There might be something that's, kind of hard for us to see that sneaks around that maybe plasma or something. That's,
well, that was, in other words, I had read the book, and he seems to be so sincere.
Yes, he is.
And has done so much research by himself with no help.
Right.
And I was wondering if there's been any other research done with the...
Yes,
there's
been others duplicating some of these photographs. Trevor had constructed a cannon also to fire at some of these things, which I thought was rather dangerous.
Then you don't know that the it's been tried. They've tried to duplicate that type
of
photography.
Others have duplicated some of these photographs.
Also,
right.
And Mr. Jenkins,
yes,
have you come across, or do you know, have you read The Morning of Magicians?
Why is that ringing a bell in my head?
Because I listen to your program, and I try to read all the books I can that you've come across. I've just come across this one in the last day or two.
That reveals a lot of the problems with scientists and their research.
Right. And you had the gentleman on 2 weeks ago that was telling, 3 weeks ago, I guess it was, telling about the difficulty we're having with the scientific community.
Oh, yes, that was
accepting.
Dr. Santilli, with General Santilli.
Yes. Well, this Morning of the Magician is a marvelous book, and I can hardly put it down.
There's others just like it, too.
So, you might pass that on. It's a great book to start with if you're getting into this area.
Yeah, we do have that problem within our academic community.
Oh, it's there.
Do not upset the apple cart, because you will be upsetting great grants and contracts and things like that. Don't give us a new idea, and don't advance our science.
Certainly.
Well, thank you very much for your program, and... be sure and look this book up, The Morning of the Magicians.
All right, thank you
very
much.
I'll read it and I recommend it.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Larry. I'm Bill Jenkins. It's Open Mind. About the flying saucer, the UFO, or the alien beings in Earth space, whatever it is. And John is on the line. Hello, John.
Hi, Bill. I had personal contact, not with my saucers, but with the Tahunga Canyon contact incidences. And I just thought I'd mention what I had and a little bit about the book.
Well, do.
I lived down, well, we still do, I guess, on the valley just west of Tahunga Canyon. And I guess it was in 52 or so. It was like a Saturday afternoon. And we're all the neighbors along the street. We're out doing like yard work and stuff. And one of the neighbors shouted, said to look up. And everybody looked up. And there were a V formation of seven discs that were, they looked like about the size of the moon looks.
Uh-huh.
About that size. Very shiny and white in formation, seven of them, flying into Tahunga Canyon. And we saw them for a good 2 or 3 minutes. And they weren't going that fast, and it looked like they picked up speed as they went away from us. Couldn't tell exactly. The book then goes into talking about, and there was a lot of sightings around that time in the Southern California area, 52. And the book tells about people that lived closer into the canyon, actually got in their cars and tried to follow the saucers in farther into the canyon. And that a couple people who lived way far into the canyon had these contacts late at night where they saw their whole houses would light up and stuff like that. And some people, I guess under hypnosis, recalled being abducted by them. So it seems like it's a pretty significant case and well-documented. A lot of people saw them at that time, and people speculated that there might have been some kind of base way back in the canyon.
Are you talking about Andrew Ruffel's book?
What?
Andrew Ruffel's book, Tahunga Canyon Contacts.
Right.
Yeah, that's a very interesting book.
So,
it's pretty well documented. A lot of people did see it, as you pointed out, and you saw them too, huh?
I saw them along with a bunch of neighbors, and...
did anybody get any pictures?
No, it was somebody said, look up, and we just watched them, you know, in amazement for a couple of minutes, and nobody saw, I guess, about
it. Well, skeptics aren't going to understand that. They think that we should be walking around with cameras ready, and when something this amazing pops up, you automatically reach for your camera.
That was amazing, and, you know, so I've seen them, and I know they're there. There's no speculation about it.
If I had a camera, I couldn't have taking a picture of the one I saw. It just happened too quickly. And
right.
I hadn't even thought of taking a picture. Yeah. I was so stunned.
Yeah, you're amazed. And it's just an amazing sight. And, you know, you want, maybe it'll turn around land or something. You don't know. Also, I went to my local college library and looked at the NASA books and the moon photos. And I sure thought I saw what looked like running across half a crater I know what you talked about, Bill, on one of your previous shows.
Mm-hmm.
A long metallic object. It was very big, and it didn't look like a glitch in the photos or anything. And
there are some very, very strange things going on the moon.
Yeah.
And we'll have to ask Dr. Krupp to explain some of those lights on the moon.
Oh, they're just natural little...
TLPs.
Natural little lights. Edwin has trouble with all of those things.
He sure does.
And the pictures on of the face on Mars, he still has trouble with. He admits it looks like a face, but we don't have enough. We really won't know until we get up there and look at it firsthand, which is, that's a good out.
I investigated a very good case down in Orange County. Before I got the information, they had called Griffith's Observatory, and I guess talked to Dr. Krupp. And that was their second shock, that he wouldn't take them seriously. First shock was seeing the UFO up close.
Yeah,
Dr. Krupp and other people, they spend most of the time denying.
That's the problem with some of these skeptics here.
Well, I know
they can't be
Edwin would like to believe, but he wants to see more data, let's put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
And there's nothing the matter with that. Good, hard data is quite necessary.
But if you show him the data, what does he do with it?
It depends on the quality of it.
He'll throw it away.
As he addresses himself to it. I don't think he would. He's he's open-minded in many, many ways.
This couple tried in vain to get him to listen to him.
Really?
They were...
Did they have anything to show him? Photographs or anything like that? Then it's... So what do you do with all of this information? It's not anything that you can hang your hat on and say, here is the empirical evidence that this exists, you see. And this is the way that...
That's all we ever get. That's what we have to work with.
Yeah.
Do like I do. I learn a little about false sensory perceptions, hypnosis, everything else, psychology. Get a little background on all of that so I can interpret some of these reports and sort out the wheat from the chaff.
Much as possible. Well, John, I appreciate you getting in here and telling us about your sightings.
Okay.
Seven of them flying in formation into Tujunga Canyon.
Yeah, and people can find the book in
Diego. And very matter-of-factly, at a man's home, he seemed to confide in me that there were aliens, there were saucers, and he described the, at that time currently, a secret which he knew about the bodies, the little men in the little jumpsuits. Has your research...
I haven't done very much on that, but Bill Moore could sure tell you a lot about it.
Well, we have a number of those cases. Leonard Stringfield, for instance, has been on the show for
spent a lot of time.
A number of times. There are a number of those little bodies. We do have them. Most of them are the little guys.
Yeah.
In fact, Steven Spielberg's movie, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, he got... You remember the little bodies at the little people at the end of the movie?
There were some in Germany that were discovered, too.
That was taken from the APRO description. Stephen used the APRO description of a number of the bodies that have been recovered.
Travis Walton and Moody, Sergeant Moody.
Now, have we ever been able to determine that the Army did or did not receive them and freeze them and dispose of them?
I don't think they disposed of them, but...
We can't find out where they are. Is that true?
Well, there are a lot of people who know where they are.
Oh, there are.
Yeah.
Well,
I'm not one of them.
I'll just have to
I'm
wait.
Not either.
Now, the next question is, are you acquainted with what's called the etheric hypothesis? The word etheric hypothesis?
Well, I've used that term before, yes.
I have a memorandum here dated 1950. Do you remember Ken Purdy? He was editor of True Magazine. He became very much interested in all of this and... began to accept what's called etheric hypothesis.
I call them Etherians sometimes.
Etherians, yes. It's a theory that explains the super densities and where they come from other than another planet.
Well, multidimensional.
Yeah, multidimensional. It's a materialization. That would help the lady that called a few calls back as to how they can materialize and where they come from.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm suspicious that some of these loud noises that are heard are the result of some of that materialization.
What loud noises are you talking about?
Once in a while, there are tremendous shattering noises, and the police and the Army Air Corps, and nobody seems to know who they are, why, or what, and it seems to me that they're related to these.
Are you talking about explosions that we sometimes experience here off the coast of Southern California and down the Mississippi River Valley and off
different places, yes.
Well, we have an idea of what they are now. They're not that.
They're not related to the saucers.
No, that's part of a Russian weapons system, and we're just getting all gridded in over here in the United States.
I see.
We will explain that in detail, by the way, for you on July 29th when Tom Bearden is here.
Oh, fine.
And how that does relate to weather control and some of the weather that we've been having.
Mm-hmm. Now, one other question. Mr. Arra, does the word Mark Probert mean anything in your research?
No, it doesn't. I don't.
Mark Probert was a trance medium. And this man was able to speak in every language or any language in the world under trance. Fascinating person. And he gave long dictations, I may have some somewhere, about the saucers, the design, how they worked, the flashing lights, and a tremendous amount of knowledge, nuclear physics, which we didn't seem to be able to understand under trance.
Is he a local person?
I don't know if he's even alive. I knew him in Seattle. I knew him in San Diego. I think his original home was San Diego. He's a trance medium. His name is Mark Probert. And he dictates by the hour to stenographers from the other side, astral or wherever the saucer people are. Is it the astral plane? Or?
Well, that's one way to look at it.
One way to look at it,
another
yes.
dimension, yes. I'd never heard of him myself, Mark Probert, but I'll see if I can find out something with him.
And the other's Mead Lane. Has his name come up in your research or your investigations? He did a great deal of work with Mr. Probert.
Was he a trans medium also?
Not really, no. But he was so deep into both the saucers and the trans medium work that I think he worked as an associate with Mr. Probert.
Mm-hmm.
No, I didn't.
Well, there's a great deal of information. I'll see if I still have the card in front of me. It's dated 1950, but I had some prior to that. I have, for example, a complete description of a man who flew in a saucer in 50.
You
of course, there are many of those now.
Well.
Pardon?
Now, why don't you send some of that to me? I'd really enjoy having that. And I'll forward on to John and MUFON and APRO and let them look at it and some other sources.
Oh, and I was the person who tabulated all of the sightings on the West Pacific coast during a given period, and we found that the flight patterns followed the magnetic meridians of the Earth.
That's not unusual at all.
And then another thing is, we had information that they were examining a fault pattern.
Is this during the war? You're talking about
pattern.
Sightings we had here in the West Coast during the war?
Pardon?
During the war? Second World War?
I didn't hear.
We had many sightings of UFOs during the war.
In relation to geodetic surveys?
Well, there's no connection that I know of to geodetic lines, but you're the first one to bring that up.
Well, I'm checking on all these things. I like to talk to people who probably can substantiate what I've heard, what I've worked with.
Well, that's fascinating.
Sorry, I can't.
I'll try to get some of this to you. It's quite old, and it might be original. Somewhere.
All right, I'd love to have it. Just because it's old, that doesn't mean it's not valid.
Yes, exactly.
All right.
Fine, I'll do that.
Okay, thank you very much, Norm. Appreciate you getting in here with us. And Jim, you're on.
Good evening, Bill.
How are you?
John.
Yeah.
I was calling in regard to the gentleman who called earlier about the American Indian, and I was just wondering, why is it that they have a Thunderbird at the top of their totem pole? Does that have anything to do with flying saucers or anything?
Well, I have never had that connection at all. I think
it's one of their gods, obviously, and
they
might have some connection.
They had a great respect for eagles and fire and thunder and forces greater than they. And it was some form of symbolism.
I was just wondering, you know, the bird that made the noise of thunder, that's like a flying saucer or something, you know.
Or a spacecraft. It could get back into, you know, the ancient lore of the Indians who were here
That'd
for thousands
of years.
That'd be a good
one to look into.
There may be some experts out there in Indian lore that have an answer.
I hope somebody's documenting everything they can before it's lost.
But I never thought about it in that way, Jim.
Okay.
All right. Thank you very much. It's Open Mind on a Saturday night. I'm Bill Jenkins. And to you about it, too, remind you that next week in studio will be with me one of the really fine researchers and authors of our time, Zachariah Sitchin, who is the author of the 12th Planet, Stairway to Heaven, and his new book is called The Wars of Gods and Men. Zachariah's work is centered on the ancient writings and cuneiforms and all of the information that came out of Sumeria, Babylonia. And those people were telling us some grand stories about alien beings coming down, being very responsible for the formation of the human society and human governments and human conflicts. And in, It came to a climax 2002 BC when we had our first nuclear war. So I think you'll find that that'll be quite fascinating. Tom Bearden here on July 27th with the weather war, an undeclared war that's going on against the United States from the Soviet Union, where they are manipulating weather. He'll give you the science behind it and the facts behind it and what's been happening and what we can do about it if we understand it. The Jewish Kabbalah will be the subject August 3rd with Dr. Philip Berg, who probably knows more about it than anyone else in the world, and what the Kabbalah had to say about UFOs, and it had a lot to say about it, reincarnation, and a lot of those mystic things, we call it now, that were very much a part of the Jewish belief system long before the Judaism that we read about in the Bible. Transmedium Thomas Jacobson will be here August 17th, and he'll bring with him Dr. Peoples. That's always fun. Robert Monroe here October or August 24th of the Monroe Institute of Applied Sciences, where serious work is done in the research of the out-of-body experience. And in fact, we're going to have two out-of-body travelers go out-of-body on the East Coast and in the out-of-body state come to this studio. We'll have a display set up for them. They'll go back to the East Coast and get back on the air and describe what they saw. So that should be a lot of fun with Robert Monroe. Okay, we have Al on the line. Hello, Al.
Hello. Does the name Virgil Armstrong mean anything to either of you two?
Certainly does.
Okay, because I went to one of his seminars not too long ago, and one thing I wanted to ask about, I guess to kind of confirm, was he mentioned the moon being rather thin in terms of, being hollow. According to what he says, the work of Vasin and Shcherbakov from Russia, they have... or maybe we have as well, the United States, sets up seismographic equipment to the moon and...
it rang like a bell, they said.
Yeah, it rang for like 3 hours or something. And
it is always ringing when anything hits it.
Right. And so they determined that it was something like 20 miles thick, the core of it, beneath the 2.5 mile layer, which is apparently the kind of just a surface layer. When you get to the bottom of the crater, apparently you get some sort of a... synthetic material which is impenetrable. That's what he was saying. Any of this confirm with what you've been able to?
Well, I don't know any more about it than that.
Well, we do know that the moon rings very unusually whenever there is an explosion on it or if there is an impact of any kind.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't have to be a huge impact. It can be a small impact. A small meteor can hit it or something the size of your fist and it will ring. Even the landing of the spacecraft of ours on it caused it to ring.
Hmm.
They also pick up sounds almost that are very similar to what you would hear if you were standing on a street in New York when the subway went underneath you. That happened with regularity. So there's a lot of strange things going on inside the moon as well as on top of it.
Yeah. Now, another fellow who called in mentioned something about seeing something in the crater is very long. And Virgil Armstrong claims that... there are these long, incredible, they scoop out the dirt out of the craters or something. They're like 5 miles long, or they have like 2.5 mile arms on them, which scoop out the dirt out of the craters. Are these inside the craters, apparently? And they were to dump out, or maybe just to clean out the craters, but he claims that there are these...
Is there some kind of publication that Virgil's come out with?
What?
Has he published anything on this?
I don't think he's published anything on this, but he refers to a couple of books where he gets a lot of his information, one of which is Alien Bases on the Moon by...
Fred Steckling.
Steckling, and the other one is Our Mysterious Spaceship Moon by Don Wilson, which he claims is out of print. He said the government squashed that one pretty quick. But they both have quite a few photographs in them.
There's another book called Somebody Else is on the Moon by George Leonard. That one is out of print.
Oh, that's the one, that was out of print. That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's in paperback, and it sells well in Europe, but there's not any over here.
Hmm. Well,
and George doesn't want to talk about it. I've asked him to come on the show a number of times, but he's said he got the message, and, anything that George and I talk about is confidential.
Right. Okay, but I just wanted to confirm that moon, the thing about it being apparently hollow or something like that.
Well, there's a lot of evidence that suggests that that could be an answer to why the moon behaves as it does.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully we'll be able to go back up there again. There was no reason to stop going up there, but we did. It certainly wasn't money that stopped us from going up there.
Yeah.
And find out more about it.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
All right, thank you. All right, Bob, you're on.
Hello there?
Yeah.
Hi, Bill?
Yes.
And John? I listen to your show a lot. The first time I've gotten to call you. I wanted to know if you knew of any people who had been abducted by UFOs, and if so, if they could recall anything.
Well, yes, it's been maybe 300 people that have recalled under hypnosis, recalled abductions. The case that I'm most interested in, though, is the Pascagoula, Mississippi case, where they could recall without hypnosis, and they were very upset, very frightened, terrified. So it was a pretty good case.
The Bill Herman case is another one. His early experiences, it did take hypnosis. In fact, Dr. Jim Harder at the University of California, Berkeley, did the hypnosis work with Bill Herman. And that's an ongoing experience in Charleston, South Carolina, that continues to this day. And now Bill has ready recollection of all of them.
Is there any kind of specific information that has been learned from them? I mean, it sounds like there's fear involved.
Oh, yes, it could be a very terrifying experience. One of the problems is that while you're under hypnosis, you can also imagine an awful lot. So sorting out the imaginary and the real has been a very difficult problem.
The thing that we found out from Bill Herman about his contact, those people were the little people that we were discussing before, and they said that their home was what we would call Zeta 1, Zeta 2 reticuli. Which is...
Barney and Bay Hill also described
evidently
it
from the same group. In fact, most of the bodies that have been retrieved are of that type. The little guys about 4 feet tall with great big heads and long fingers. Their muscles are different than ours. They're stratified rather than the long, sinewy kind that we have.
The leety.
The leety. Their skin is like like a mushroom, a button mushroom. It has that feeling to it. Very small lips and ears. Not too much of a digestive tract. No sexual reproduction process seems to be going on. They've figured out another way to do that. And but those are the ones that generally are referred to now in the circles as the reticulans.
That's very interesting.
There is a book about that. I think Colonel Stevens wrote a great deal of the material that came from Bill Herman, and I don't know where that book is available right now, but I think it's through Genesis 2 Publications in Phoenix, Arizona. It's a good book.
What's it called?
Contact with Reticuli.
Okay.
All right,
thank you very much.
All right, thank you very much, Bob. And thank you, John, for dropping in with us on this Saturday night.
Thank you for inviting me, Bill.
And you'll be back on the 11th on the All Night Show as, while Ray Bream's away, you're going to talk flying saucers. That'll be fun. You can talk to the nation that night. Next week with me, Zachariah Sitchin and the Gods of War and Men. You'll find it fascinating. Come on.
Happy celebration, 25.